You're in charge.
This is going to be interesting, I can see. I'm going to call the meeting of the House Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs and Emergency Preparedness together.
And the Senate Committee will come to order. Thank you.
Good job.
I got that. I can follow well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Oh, I would point out to you, our vice chair generally gets about a minute when we start. So I don't know if your vice chair gets any time. But
no, but
I don't get anything.
That's because we're
nobody respects me. You know
thank you, Mr. Chair. I want you to know that I think we're all pretty patriotic, but we seem to be more patriotic when it comes to July 4th and Memorial Day and Veterans Day. But I think patriotism is supporting our country all the time. And but besides, in spite of that, it's been 137 years that we've been celebrating Memorial Day. And it has remained one of Oregon's most cherished patriotic holidays that we've ever had. And it has the spirit of this day. It hasn't changed. It remains a day to honor those who died defending our freedom and democracy. And I'm sure many of you are going to be attending a lot of events in your area. But I just like to say we passed in 2016 SCR 206, which honored two Vietnam veterans who brothers that died. I went to school with one of them, George Wright, and his brother. They died within 2 years of each other, and there were only 41 families in the entire United States where there was more than one member of a family dying. But we are having, we are erecting our sign on I-84 between Gresham and Sandy on Friday, and we are meeting at the Good Shepherd Church that's located in Boring, and a lot of people are going to come, and I just wanted to say all of you are welcome to come too. It's at 1:30 at the Good Shepherd Church in Boring. Thank you, Mr. Chairs.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging.
Absolutely. Representative Escobar.
A little follow-up to Senator Anderson's talk about the boys that lost their lives. They were 2 years and a day apart, I believe, both in Vietnam. One was Army, one was Marine. And I was honored to carry that on the House floor. But it also affected me as well, because in Southern Oregon, we had two brothers that were killed in Vietnam, and it was one of those 40-some families. And I went to school with one of the brothers, the Rowdens, and from that, they came to get the third boy, the draft, and the parents refused. And that's really what started the sole surviving son situation in Vietnam, because very tragic, losing two, and then they came to get the third boy, and thank God the parents said no.
Isn't that Saving Private Ryan? That movie?
Anything else?
Yeah.
So today we have a series of informational hearings, meetings, to update on previous legislation or actions that have been taken and potentially point us in directions of what may be coming up. So we're going to start with an update on the selection of the State Resilience Officer in Heidi. Welcome.
I didn't recognize her.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, and members of the committees. I'm Heidi Moad. I'm Governor Kate Brown's Public Safety Policy Advisor. And since taking over the role in 2013, I have been working in part on some emergency management and resilience issues. As you all know, in 2015, you passed House Bill 2270 to create the Seismic Resilience Officer for the state. And I am happy to say that as of 11:20-ish this morning, we have a newly confirmed Seismic Resilience Officer for the state of Oregon. So I brought my special guest up here with me, and I will let him tell all of you about himself, and then we can answer whatever questions you have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heidi. Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, thank you for your support. My name is Mike Harriman. I was the nominee until 11:20 a.m. this morning and got confirmed by the Senate, full Senate. Currently, I was been the Director of Emergency Operations for the Oregon Health Authority Public Health Division for the last 10 years, overseeing the public health emergency support system for public health medical services, and in the last 3 years, focused mainly on the Cascadia playbook, mainly on Play 2 and Play 8. Play 2 is life safety. And Play 8 is outside resources, working with our federal partners. I did a 22-year career in the military, retired as a senior non-commissioned officer in 1999, and then went into state government, spent 4 years at Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So when they moved to Salem, I looked for a job in Portland and was selected to work in the Public Health Division and worked with the Emergency Medical Services, Radiation Protection Services, the Drinking Water Program, and some other. Also in my 10 years, for 18 months, I also had the honor of being the state EMS director for 18 months while that program went through some reorganization and turned it over a couple years ago to the current leadership there and within the Public Health Division. And look forward to serving the state and Governor Brown's administration and moving resiliency efforts forward. This is a big area. There's a lot of people have already reached out, would like to talk to me about their ideas and stuff, and I'm all ears. I'll be like a sponge and take in as much as I can, but also, you know, within the limitations of just one person and the fact that there's not going to be any one particular thing we can do all the time, and we have to take chunks off. So I think the resiliency plan itself speaks volume. I was on the task force for the Senate Bill 33 for the Oregon Health Authority's representation, and so I'm pretty well aware of that. I have a good relationship with the chair of OSPAC, Jay Wilson, and I know many of the folks, and I'll be working in the Dogamis area up on the ninth floor of the Portland State Office Building when I'm in the office. Otherwise, I'll be on the road talking to state agencies, locals, and our tribal partners and the general public when I get the opportunity.
Welcome. It seems like we're very fortunate to have somebody of your qualifications to do this job. So. Any comments or questions?
No, he's before my other committee already.
So you've already had your shot.
I already threw the book at him. He gets the other chapters with it, okay?
I see. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, welcome, Mike. I'm happy to see you up there. I'd love to talk to you more in depth at some point. So when you get settled, except after hearing that, you're probably already settled. And thank you, Heidi, very much. Are you still involved, or
Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, and Representative Boone? I will continue to work on these areas and issues. I think internally we have some sorting out to do on what I would call preparedness versus resilience. Mm-hmm. And I think I'll still be working a lot with the Office of Emergency Management on the preparedness side of things. Tons of overlap between the two, obviously. I think Mike and I are going to get to know each other better than we ever thought we would, and I'm so happy to have him as a part of Governor Brown's team and really be able to focus on the infrastructure issues, especially because that is such a huge project, and I'm just grateful to have someone that can really start chipping away at it.
And somebody, with your indulgence, Mr. Chair, somebody asked me just today, well, so who is it? And I said, I don't know. I'm going to find out. And so you don't look 108, but after doing all that, you must be at least. That's amazing resume. So, well.
Chair Lively, Representative Boone, thank you very much. You know, it's one of those things, doing a military career, you join the military, not necessarily do a career, but 22 years later, it was really an honor to serve, and I was a veteran of the Gulf War, so I was with the Oregon National Guard when I deployed with the 21A6 Maintenance Company and did our duty over there and came back and brought everybody back with us, so it was a great honor to serve the state, and I'm glad I retired, but also I'm glad I got into state government and just led me to here. Who would have thought? So here I am.
You know, this is called secondarily the House. What is it called? The Hotel California. You'll get that.
Okay.
We call our committee the Committee of Doom.
Oh.
The Committee of Doom.
In more ways than others, Heidi knows.
Anything else? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
We look forward
appreciate
to working
it.
With you.
Thank you very much.
Sure. So our next topic. So I know that our Senate colleagues, 2 years ago or so, worked on this issue for a while, having to do with the hiring preference, best preference, and some questions about interpretation or what was the intent
of the legislation, and then came over to the House, and we've spent time twice working on it, and we still have not, didn't reach a conclusion as to what we would or wouldn't do. In the meantime, there was a court case going forward, and now the court case has been decided, so I thought it would be important that we all hear what the court ruled. And then after we've heard that conversation, we can decide if there's still, based on that conversation, if there's still work that we may want to do in this particular area. So.
Well, sure, third time's a charm. You guys
maybe that's it. Yeah. Okay, so Gail, welcome.
Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I'm Gail Stevens, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I am covering for Belissa Sidlick, another attorney from our office, to discuss the recent veterans preference case just mentioned from the Oregon Court of Appeals, Multnomah County Sheriff's Office versus Edwards. I'll refer to it as the Edwards case. To remind you of the law itself, the veterans preference law, it applies to public employers in the state, and that's defined broadly. It applies to school districts, higher ed, cities, counties, TriMet, many others, including the legislative branch here at the Capitol. The veterans preference law applies to us in hiring. And the law requires public employers to give a preference to qualifying vets during the screening stage and the interview stage, including internal promotions. Boley's rules that accompany the veterans preference laws require the preference to be applied at each stage of the hiring process. So that sounds simple enough, but based on state, federal, and administrative claims, public employers have struggled applying this law to their actual hiring processes. Edwards is one example, and I'll start with that case, and then briefly I'll leave you with a short list of areas of ambiguity that remain that I have created based on an overview of recent cases from state and federal court, and then also recent administrative claims. Again, the case is Multnomah County Sheriff's Office v. Edwards, decided by the Oregon Court of Appeals on April 16, 2016, and I'll be referring to it as Edwards. It's an appeal of a final Boley order. That's the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. The plaintiff in that case, the complainant in that case, Edwards, first filed with Boley. Boley made a finding and issued a final order, which was appealed to the Court of Appeals, alleging that the county violated the veterans preference law. Boley issued an order indicating that the county did indeed violate the law. The facts of the case are pretty simple. Three sergeants applied internally at the sheriff's office for a lieutenant position. One was a disabled vet, Edwards, and he did not get the position, so he filed with Boley. The Oregon Court of Appeals upheld Boley's final order, determining that the county, who was the employer, violated the law. It violated the law when it failed to devise coherent methods to give special consideration to veterans, apply those methods at each stage of the hiring process, and by requiring the preference to be followed at each stage, the court gave a nod to Boley's each stage rule. But I say a nod because the rule itself wasn't officially challenged, so that's not final at this point. The court also upheld an award of $50,000 in emotional distress damages to the complainant, Edwards. They did not address the complainant's alternative ground for damages, which was a claim based on lost wages for a job he, even if the process had been followed properly, he may not have gotten, but he claimed, having not been given a proper process, there was no way to determine whether he was entitled to lost wages or not. The court did not decide that alternative claim and issued $50,000 in emotional distress damages, the alternative. Other than clarifying that employers must follow the each stage rule from Boley, the case, the statute itself and the rules still leave some questions unanswered. Again, in doing an overview of some other recent cases in state and federal court and before Boley, here are some points just to highlight the parts of the veterans preference law that still remain somewhat ambiguous and could be clarified. The each stage requirement that all employers, public employers in Oregon will now follow, that the Court of Appeals has clarified, it is law. is still has some difficulties. It's a difficult step to apply because sometimes one process can have stages within it. For instance, choosing an eligibility list can involve a series of tests. Should the veteran get the points at each test they take during the eligibility list process? Also, sometimes interviews involve meet and greet the candidate sort of events. A literal interpretation of that rule would mean that every single vet would get a bonus for attending, would get their veterans preference points. Some employers like to call references before they make their final decision. If that's the case, that would be another stage in the process, and someone would get veterans preference points again for a reference check. And so that becomes difficult practically to apply at each stage, even though the court has determined that this rule, for now at least, is valid. Another part of the law that is confusing is a stage called the initial application screening. The steps for the screening are unclear. It's not entirely clear if the screening is just to involve minimum qualifications and that's all, or if the preferred qualifications should factor in and favorites should be chosen at that stage, or everyone should slide through as long as they meet the minimum qualifications. That's unclear. That part of the law requires points even when a process is otherwise unscored, so you're essentially having to apply numerical points to a stage during a process that you may never use again. Because if you're not using a scored process and yet one small stage that you perform requires points, it's not clear what you would do with those points when that's not the system that you're using. So that would be confusion with the initial application screening. The eligibility list itself is also confusing. The statute describes a test or series of tests, but doesn't give much more information, and that also raises the each stage problem, because if it's a series of tests, is there one lump of points that the veteran gets in the eligibility list stage, or does each stage within the eligibility list, each test, for instance, within the eligibility list stage get points? That would be a lot of points, but it's not entirely clear. Transferable skills are mentioned. Vets often have skills that they bring from the military to the workplace that don't seem to apply on their face, but we can use skills translators and see that someone who had a fairly random, obscure job on a foreign ship can do many things in an office, operate certain equipment, etc., and have vast technical skills. But the statute seems to indicate that the employer translate those skills. That's a difficult thing for an employer to do. They have skills translator websites, but it's the vet himself who knows the most about the skills that he performed while in the military, and our statute even directs vets to consult with professionals to understand their transferable skills, so leaving that stage to employers is confusing, that they would be the ones to translate the skills. For unscored stages, there's a requirement that special consideration be given, but that's not defined anywhere in the statute. So what does special consideration mean? For the scored stages, 5 points are to be awarded for vets and 10 points for disabled vets at each stage, but there's never a total pool that's designated by the statute, and so everyone assumes it's 100 points at each stage. But an employer could sort of sidestep the spirit of the law and make the point pool really big, like 1,000 points, and that would dilute the veterans' preference points. There's simply no requirement that each 5 or 10 point award be out of 100 points total. There are some due process implications that arise with this statute. They're not on their face in the statute, but when you offer an expectation like this through state law, you can create a property right. And this statute, at least one court has found, creates a property right for a public employee, even an at-will public employee. So due process claims could be brought in state and federal court based on that property right, depending on the process that's afforded to the particular employee, substantive and procedural due process claims. And then there's some question over damages that remains at the administrative level. While court cases that are brought over the Veterans Preference Statute allow compensatory damages and back wages and even reinstatement, at the administrative level, it isn't quite as clear what damages could be awarded. The Court of Appeals has said emotional distress damages are okay, and that could be clarified as well as far as lost wages go. Overall, in summary, it appears from state and federal cases and administrative claims that these statutes are creating a risk for public employers who are attempting to comply with the law and the rules, but they don't understand various requirements or find them difficult to follow. You have choices. You can leave the law untouched. Boley and courts will be clarifying ambiguities in current cases and cases to come, undoubtedly. They make those decisions on a case-by-case basis. You could amend the law, and that could include clarifying delegation to Boley to assist with clearer rules. You could repeal the law and enact a new comprehensive scheme would be another choice, and other choices, and I'm happy to discuss the implications.
We're still down to two choices here, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Lucas. Option choice number two is not really an option. Likewise, no. So.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Other questions? Didn't make it simpler, did it?
No. I was hoping for just like, this is all you need to do.
Sure. In the case, was Edwards represented by Boley in the state, or was Edwards represented by private counsel?
Edwards had private counsel. The DOJ was involved defending Boley's interpretation of its rule and Boley's interpretation of the statute. So, good question, and I can clarify for you after this. I know the Department of Justice represented Boley. I do not know that they technically represented Edwards himself.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. The reason I ask that question is I'm trying to look for, I guess, legal counsel that was in the courtroom and went through this that represented Boley and Edwards in conjunction with legislative counsel to say, okay, what's the best practices suggestion here? Repeal isn't an option. So therefore, if we're going to clarify it, I'm sure that there must have been at least a private counsel, the Justice Department counsel. You folks, as you well know, wrote the first portion of the law. I know you didn't, but somebody wrote it. This is a intricate, complex, and politically volatile piece of legislation. And getting all the professional advice possible to figure out which of those courses of action, whether we need to take positive action in terms of putting some clarifications in that haven't been decided by the court, or in getting an interpretation from, because obviously private counsel, if it's who I think it is, probably represented a bunch of people. I see a nod over there.
It is.
It is, okay. So I won't mention that because we can't confirm that. Then the question is you know, how do we best clarify this in a cooperative manner versus just allowing Boley to do it? That's the course of action. So I think knowing who the attorneys are, and I'm not sure which committee is going to take the lead on this, but I think House at a third time would actually be better off than we are. But it seems to me that even...
You're going to have a lot of new people.
Right, yeah. I mean, we need to have a good grasp for what the court was thinking, the lawyers were kicking, and what they presented. Which then also tells us what Boley's position was in depth, because as you pointed out, this is a bit complex.
Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, yes. And I have all of the cases, other cases too, before me, and the attorneys of record are listed. I can work with Melissa Sidlick and Cheyenne Ross to make sure we have all potential interested parties.
I didn't say I was volunteering. I'm just.
Any other comments or questions? Obviously, it requires some action.
I knew you were going to say that.
And maybe we ought to talk about it. Yes, it would be our third. The bill started over there, but I'm not sure after listening to this, though, that the bill we were working with, if that's really the mechanism at this point, or whether we can come in a different direction. So we ought to talk about how to get that.
I agree, and I think trying to get a better grasp of the three legal positions and what points we need clarity on, because this is always the final implementation. This has always been out of our grasp.
But thank you very much for bringing this. I mean, that was the intent, to see kind of next steps. So.
You're welcome.
Thank you. But my observation is that the largest bone of contention in this thing has been decided by the court. So.
Yeah.
I think that's off the table.
Okay. Moving on. So the next we're going to have a discussion about implementing of House Bill 2645. And so I've not been here as long as many of you have, but one of the things I've noted since I have been here that sometimes what we pass and what how it's implemented is sometimes different than what we thought. Doesn't mean it's wrong, only means what we thought our intentions were, and then what happens on the ground is different. And this is a case where we've heard that that might be the case. What we may learn is what we passed is exactly what we passed and is correct. But I wanted to make sure we had a chance to have the conversation early in this particular bill about what that is to make sure it fits. And if it's, you know, we're the legislature, so ultimately if the law we passed was not what we intended, we have the ability to correct it or amend it. So we're going to talk now about House Bill 2645, which was the priority enrollment with universities.
And Mr. Chair, the sponsor of the bill is
yes,
here.
Yes, thank you, Representative Witt. Were you sitting out there?
I was just finding a place to sit down, Mr. Chairman. No, I just arrived. Thank
okay.
you.
So welcome. Since this was your bill, you started it. Do you have anything to say before we start having the conversation about it?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This, like so many other bills, is one that tried to make things better for a certain class of people, namely the veterans that have served the state and our country. And I've watched as a number of our higher ed institutions, both the community colleges and the university system, have struggled to implement it. And I have watched some very good work done. And I have watched these institutions try and implement something that, frankly, was not easy for a number of them. And I also understand that the bill created expectations among our veterans community, and they are hoping that we are able to implement this in a fashion that it makes veterans' preference a priority for all, presumably 4 years of a baccalaureate degree. With that said, the bill was intended to be aspirational, and I see good work being done in a lot of sectors to that end. And to the extent that there are expectations for something bigger and grander, I think we might be well served, Mr. Chairman, to have a group come together to help chart a path to making that possible, and in a fashion that works for everyone. And I think that's the rub here. It's difficult to be able to accommodate all the interests given the institutional challenges that we face in implementing it. So thank you for this opportunity.
Sure, thank you. So we have representatives here from Oregon State University of Oregon and the Oregon Community College Association. So I'll call the at least two from Oregon State first. And so I just want to express my appreciation to the Oregon State University of Oregon anyway that did meet with me earlier on so we could talk through some of this and hear some of what the questions in that were. So I think we have Rebecca and Donald from. So Rebecca is the registrar, and Donald Phillips is Army Veteran Senior at Oregon State University.
And Mr. Chair, both chairs, Mr. Chairs, I forgot to mention earlier, John Wyckoff is ill in Portland, but he did send his written testimony, and we've uploaded it to OLIS, so he couldn't be here today.
So he's not, but he should have his testimony. I should have looked.
Chair Lively.
Welcome.
Chair Boquist, thank you for taking the time today to hear us out. My name is Donald Phillips. I am an Oregon native, graduated from Oregon City High School 2006. Did 4 years in the Army as a medic, including a deployment to Nasiriyah, Iraq, from 2009 to 2010. I am currently pursuing my Bachelor's of Psychology at OSU, and I'm also the president of the Oregon State University Veteran and Family Student Association. I am one of the veterans who was a bit confused when the bill started to be enacted. A big part about it was the fact that it is for people using benefits specifically, not just all veterans, but veterans using benefits and their dependents, and that 36-month timeline on the post-9/11 GI Bill. With those 36 months, even though 12 credit hours is considered full-time, you have to take a minimum of 15 on average to get your degree, which can be very difficult with the way that the GI Bill certifies, because every class you take has to be within your degree path. When that happens, you're forced some terms to take 18 or 19 credits, while other terms you can only take the minimum amount because of availability of classes, both whether they are offered that term as well as the amount of seats in it. With the first term priority registration, as it is currently in the bill, that can help to get into the first few classes, but that doesn't help when a student, such as myself, is in their final year and they have to now take 16 credits of 400 level classes. Some of my colleagues at school are in engineering programs where they have to decide which class they're going to fail because they had to get all of their, it's the only term they could get all four of their classes in, and it was just too high of a workload. Due to the time frame on the bill as well, you have a lot of veterans who are transitioning from the military into the civilian world while they are pursuing their degrees, which puts another level of stress on many of them because time in service changes the way a person deals with stress, as some of you know. I think that the bill as it is a good concept, but I don't think the one term is enough to really help those veterans pursuing their benefits, especially since you can't take summer courses, really, with how the summer courses are laid out and how many veterans who are using the post-9/11 GI Bill specifically use the housing allowance attached to it to survive while they are attending courses. So, currently, since the bill was passed, I've been, myself and other veterans at Oregon State University have been working with the registrar's office, Rebecca, and trying to figure out a way to make it work to help the veterans who need the help. And a big thing that I've come to realize as I've started to see how the cogs in the machine turn is that an important part of this is going to be the wording, because the way it was before, a lot of people had a lot of expectations that it seemed like that's how it said, and it didn't end up coming out. So I just think that that's probably a pretty big, important focus on that, redoing this whole thing.
Rebecca?
Hello. Good afternoon, Chairs Boquist and Lively and honorable members of the Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committees. Thank you for your time today. So I'm sure you know that all institutions do this, but it's important for me to say that OSU has always worked to implement all legislative mandates. And as of this summer, we're going to be implementing 2645 using manual updates to each of our new veterans or the dependents on campus who are receiving benefits. And it's hard work, but we do it because we want to serve the benefits or the students who are receiving benefits, all the veterans. We also, of course, want to meet the legislative requirements. But I think it's important to talk a little bit about the many things that our institution and other institutions do to support veterans on campus. And priority registration is sort of one of the pieces of that puzzle, but not the whole piece. And right now, just to sort of give a broad overview, OSU offers a Veterans Resource Center for students to sort of relax on campus between courses and to also connect with like-minded individuals or people that may have also served where they can talk with each other. We also offer a place where veterans can find resources that are specifically offered to them and that they can find out about all kinds of access to benefits on campus and off. The institution has a veteran service advisor who works to connect the veterans with appropriate benefits that they may or may not know about, especially if they're recently out of service. We also have three certifying officials who ensure that all of the veterans on campus who are receiving benefits or dependents so that they can maximize their benefits without any delay in their payment. And if any of you have ever worked with the VA, you know that that can be extremely complex and bureaucratic, and so we try our best to set that up so that the process is as seamless as possible for our students. We've also, in the last 2 years, we did a formal program review of all of veteran services on our campus, and it really was helpful because it resulted in improved services to veterans, such as increased staffing. We added a position, support and professional development that either directly supports veterans or supports the staff who work to serve veterans on campus. And then we also provide a lot of programming and co-curricular experiences for veterans. There's a lot of social engagements, different opportunities such as football games, movies on campus that might be supportive of veterans, and just social outings. There's barbecues, things of that nature that are really helpful for our veterans. So the fact of the matter is that priority registration can definitely assist students, but it is just one of the pieces of the puzzle to make sure that people have the right service and support. And I think all campuses struggle with a bigger problem than priority registration, and we call it, on our campus, we call it course access. And with appropriate course access, priority registration becomes somewhat irrelevant, because if everybody can get the courses they need when they need them, nobody needs priority registration. But for the past 4 years, and probably much longer, but I've been at Oregon State for about 4 years, we've had multiple conversations with different groups on campus about priority registration. And in the last 6 months, we decided to host a priority registration forum for students on campus so that they could talk with campus administrators and sort of air their concerns about getting into the courses that they need in a timely manner. And it was interesting because outside of some really restricted groups who might have time constraints, like day-to-day time constraints, the end result was overwhelming support for access to courses from term to term in order to graduate on time rather than kind of this idea of priority registration. But it all boils down to funding, of course, because without appropriate funding and support for course access, it's really hard to offer enough courses for all of the students who are coming to our campuses. And we are critically aware of the problem. We're working on it. Right now, we're sort of talking about two major things on our campus. We're thinking about buying a software tool that can help us determine what courses are needed and when based on what majors and program students are pursuing so that we can better offer that coursework. But the second thing we're doing is to offer the course in a time frame that makes sense for students to graduate on time and help them be a little bit more lockstep so that they can finish in a time frame that works. Additionally, I think it's important just to mention that in the last 6 years, we've offered about $1.5 million a year in what we are calling access funds. And what we did is we found courses where we felt like there was a bottleneck. And in those bottlenecks, we said, okay, we need to offer more sections of these courses so that students weren't sort of finding themselves in their senior year and needing a course before they could take, as a prerequisite, before they could take the course they needed to actually graduate. So it's helped, but it's sort of been a kind of a dent in this bigger problem that we're trying to solve. I want to just offer a quick snippet on how some of our systems work, too, because I think it's always easy for people like me from the outside to say, oh, can't you just push a button? Can't you just make this work? And the more you dig in, the more you realize it's really difficult. And so to set up our student information system for registration to be ready each term, which is 4 terms for us, it takes about 3 weeks of work with 2 full-time professionals doing the actual setup. So it's definitely not a trivial task. And at last count, there was over 700 steps in order to actually make that happen. And so some schools might have a more simplified version of that, or some may have a more complex, but I've worked at both community colleges and Oregon State in Oregon and can affirm that complexity exists at the community college as well as at four-year institutions. And our student information systems do really great work for us, but all of the data and every way we touch it sort of impacts other processes, and so it's just not a quick and easy setup. And it's just important for us to remember how complex that is, because when we make a change, it sort of has a ripple effect throughout the system. But as an outcome to the student forum we hosted in March, OSU decided to implement a priority registration process where student groups and different student populations can request priority registration at OSU and describe why they think it's critical for their success. And our senior vice provost for academic affairs will review the requests and make a determination on them. And we just started this this spring as a result of that forum. So at the end of the day, we sort of understand that this committee, along with all of us, cares deeply about veterans and the dependents of the veterans who served. OSU recently decided to award priority registration for all veterans and their dependents who are receiving benefits, and we plan to implement that in 2017. So I'd like to say in closing that OSU supports veterans and their success, and we recognize that support for the veterans is done through advocacy in a broad way, and that priority registration is a piece of that puzzle. We also want to make sure that veterans have the right support on campus to be successful in school. If there is going to be a conversation, I know Representative Witt mentioned this, about how we might broaden this or attack this a little bit differently than the legislation that was passed, we'd welcome an opportunity to come back and participate in that and offer any assistance or sort of subject matter expertise on the registration system. So thank you.
I apologize. I don't think we correctly got your name and your title for the record.
You're correct. I'm sorry. My name is Rebecca Mather, and I'm the University Registrar at Oregon State University.
Thank you very much. Take us into the Evans, please.
Thank you, Chair. I have a couple of comments and questions, and these are mostly from Western Oregon University, so they not directly relate, but it's in the military sometimes information is passed through lots of talks with lots of folks. And Western is an NCAA Division II school, so it doesn't quite obviously have the same brand availability and brand access as OSU and U of O and perhaps PSU. One of the concerns that was shared with me is that, and again, this is not anything other than something to avoid as we move forward, there's widespread concern and widespread frustration that, especially at the larger universities, where athletes get priority scheduling because of the needs for their, I can only assume, training and everything else, that because there's more money involved from the athletic department or from boosters or whatever for that access, that veterans' access, though included as a priority, is perhaps not getting the same care. And I just, for myself, want to make sure that as we move forward, if that in fact proves to be the case, that at institutions, veterans are put after the athletes that are there, that would probably be a really bad decision.
Thank you. Other comments, questions?
I actually have a question of Representative Witt, if you would indulge me.
Most certainly.
I'm intrigued by the progress that was discussed here, but my recollection of the intention seems to be slightly different of what I just heard in testimony. And since you are the author of the original bill, as the chair of the Senate committee that had this, I was anticipating something broader at the institutions. Am I missing something, Representative?
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Boquist, no, you're not. And the original intent of the bill was a broad-based preference or priority enrollment. As it progressed through the process, it became clear that it was going to be difficult to be able to, I think, implement the full bore program, and as a matter of political expediency, I think expectations about the institutional requirements were rolled back. I don't think anyone ever tried, certainly didn't succeed in rolling back the expectations of the community that it was intended to serve. And so I think our ability to deliver the intended purpose of the bill and the expectations is disjointed at this point. And that's why I've suggested that there is likely a need, my editorial, for a group to sit down and try and bring those two into balance and frankly find a way to get to the bill's original intent.
Thank you. I mean, my only observation, and I'm certainly not looking for comment for OSU because we have seven institutions out there, and the good Representative Evans pointed out, you know, one perspective of two, and I think we're going to see a lawyer here very shortly from the third institution. And I'm not an educator, and I'm not on joint ways and means at the moment, thank goodness. But several of the things that you described to me as the registrar are things I would have thought the seven institutions were already doing in terms of computerization, the ability to look forward, the ability to schedule, so on and so forth. I do appreciate the good veteran's point of view, and I had forgotten the 36-month window in how the military can't add math. Right? So whoever dreamed it up was looking at a budget, not about a veteran, which I'm sure those of us who are veterans realize what that problem is. And that's not an institutional problem, but it just seems to me that we haven't gotten, I mean, it's easy to register, and I'll just point out that I have funded multiple of my children through institutions, including two in yours, right? And I guess I've been using the wrong terminology, because it's always, you know, register for those classes and register for this, and I guess the new term is make sure you get course access at the right time, right? So the verbiage, even with my own six children, seems to be screwed up here, even though we're writing the check. So I'm trying to be polite, since there's only two institutions here, but I'm in full agreement with Representative Witt. I'm not sure we got to where we wanted to go.
And so I have a question to follow. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned, and I appreciate all the information, and I had some of that earlier when I talked to somebody from your university. But so you mentioned going forward, though, that you've clarified, and I appreciate there's others asking for priorities, but you've clarified, and so you will be implementing, if I heard you correct, I'm not trying to put words in that, you'll be further implementing the veterans preference priority. What does that mean?
So the answer is yes, we will be doing that, and we'll be doing it in 2017. Ideally, we'd love to implement that for winter registration 2017, but what that means is we've got to have our system ready in October because registration starts in November. And so I'm not sure if we can meet that deadline, but sometime before fall of 2017, we will implement so that our veteran students receive benefits and the dependents who are receiving benefits, because it's so critically important for those dependents as well, they will have priority registration.
But will that priority be the when they register the first time, or will it be every time they sign up?
Every time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll follow, Mr. Chair. Help me, I'm a dumb farmer here, okay? So we're talking course access. What you're saying is when they register for courses, am I right here? When we register for courses each term, that's when we're going to try and make sure that they, because of the funding model, and so that they actually get access to those courses, not just register to go to college. Am I correct?
Right. And what happens, though, is that it's up to them, right? So as with any student, we say, okay, it's your turn to register. And we hope and pray that they take the courses that are in their degree plan that they need to get closer to graduation. The nice thing about veterans is that they understand what those restrictions are, and they are dead set on making sure that they get those courses. So they're our most savvy students in terms of sort of taking the courses they need when they need them.
Follow, Mr. Chair. I know you cannot answer this question, but do you have, and we're going to hear from one other institution, but this is, and of course we are getting written testimony from Mr. Wyckoff, but do we have a feel for what the other six institutions, or five, you don't have to speak for Oregon State, and I know you can't speak, do you registers talking back and forth? Is this new approach and new way of doing things that might be computer driven here, it sounds like, being shared amongst the all of the HEC members? You don't know.
I mean, I can tell you that the four-year public registrars meet quarterly.
Okay.
We try to put our heads together once a term and talk about what we're doing and how we can share and help each other. And it's very successful. We just 2 weeks ago met at Western Oregon, and we had an all-day meeting, and we talk about these things. So we are doing that, and I know everyone is very interested in improved course access, because it doesn't matter when you can register if the courses aren't available for you.
One final thought. You offered to help and participate, you know, if we were looking to go forward. Could I ask you another favor?
It depends.
Since you're meeting quarterly with the registrars, could you convey to them, at least for myself and maybe for the good representative on my far right, that this is of keen interest of us going into the 2017 legislative session?
Yeah.
And a solution forthwith would be appreciated, because we would prefer to have participatory solutions rather than directive solutions.
Mm-hmm. And we, yes, I will definitely carry that forward, and we appreciate that very much because sometimes the operational logistics get pretty hairy, right. And if we can participate up front in those conversations, that's really helpful. So,
thank you.
Representative Boone.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe, Mr. Phillips, maybe this is for you. without making you answer for the feds, is this an issue that the federal government needs to, like, you know, I can just remember in my college years and my kids' college years, sometimes, some terms, something happens. They get in a bad wreck, or something happens, they can't go to school, they're going to lose time. Does that sort of negate the track they're on as far as their benefits?
Representative Boone, Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, that is a great question, and it can. It can definitely completely derail everything that's going on. Recently, the VA has changed a little bit where if a student has to withdraw from a course, they ask for extenuating circumstances, which can change the way it's going on. A clarification on the course access, Chair Boquist. Well, it's true that course access, like having enough seats for everybody, is the ideal. When one person can register about a week before another person, that makes a huge difference on whether you can get into classes or not. I personally have went through my entire college career not having any sort of preferential registration, and that has made it so that several terms I couldn't get into the smaller seat courses, which are the later ones. The early courses were at OSU, you can have 400 students in a health class. Doesn't really translate when you're pursuing a psychology major and you need a writing intensive course that has 30 seats. Mm. So, that's
simple. Anything else for this group? Thank you very much for taking the time and coming down and speaking with us. So, next, Sam Hill. Associate General Counsel for the University of Oregon. Thank you for being here.
So, good afternoon, Chair Lively and Chair Boquist and members of the community committee. My name is Sam Hill, and I am Associate General Counsel at the University of Oregon. And I was asked by my colleagues to come here today to talk with you about how we are implementing the House Bill 2645 at the University of Oregon and the protocols we're putting in place currently to make certain that by the effective date, we not only meet the minimum requirements of the bill but exceed them. So if it's useful to you, I'll go over what protocols we discuss implementing currently to make certain that we're meeting the minimum requirements of the bill, and then speak to what we're doing to exceed those minimum requirements. So in order to meet the minimum requirements of the bill, we anticipate amending our application to advise students about the bill and the priority established by the bill, in hopes that will help solicit information from students to allow us to identify students who are eligible for the priority. And we're also going to be creating a list of qualified students once we receive that information, who've provided the requisite documentation to allow us to determine eligibility, and provide it to the three units on our campus who will need to coordinate to ensure that the priority is implemented. On our campus, those three departments are our student orientation department, our advising department, and our registrar's office. Coordinating with those three units is required to ensure that qualified applicants who complete orientation are able to register before qualified students who have not completed orientation and non-qualified students who have completed orientation. Currently, students are released to register at the University of Oregon following an advising session for their specific discipline. Advising sessions are critical to assist students to identify courses that are necessary to ensure that they're timely pursuing the requirements of their individual degrees. Different disciplines host advising sessions at different times throughout the day on the second day of our University of Oregon's orientation session. We're working on protocols to ensure that qualified students either receive advising before non-qualified students or to ensure that no students are released to register regardless of whether they've completed advising until all of the qualified students have completed advising and are then released to register. We are also considering hosting an earlier orientation session for qualified students, which will turn in large part on the number of qualified students who enroll, because we currently don't collect sufficient information to know what the numbers are going to be. We don't yet know if that's administratively and financially feasible, but it's certainly something that we're considering. Like our other university counterparts, we're working to comply with the statute prior to the next academic year. And like our OSU colleagues, our plan is to not only meet the bill's minimum requirements, but to exceed the requirements of the bill by extending priority registration for eligible students beyond the first term beginning in fall 2017. We're looking forward to working with student advocates on our campus to ensure that they are receiving the services they need to succeed when they're at the University of Oregon. And if our students feel there's a gap between the legislation passed in 2015 and their original intent, I know that my colleagues in enrollment management will be working with them in the interim to figure out what policies and language would best serve them as we continue to finesse our protocols at the University of Oregon. As my OSU colleagues noted, priority registration is simply one mechanism by which our universities serve our veteran students. At the U of O, we have a student veteran center that serves as a resource and touch point for student veterans, the Veterans and Family Student Association, and the Veterans Friendly Listeners Program connect students, veterans with resources such as family housing and work-life services. We also have an Office of Veterans Affairs within the Office of the Registrar that helps eligible student veterans, reservists, and dependents obtain educational benefits in compliance with procedures and regulations of the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. And like my OSU colleagues, I'm certain that my colleagues in enrollment management and our registrar's office would be happy to continue to work with you as we think through how best to implement the intentions of the bill. And I'm happy to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Are there questions? Well, we appreciate your efforts to go beyond the minimum standards and try to implement that. I think that's part of what we're talking about here is how we get to that level. So we appreciate that. We appreciate your being here to
Great.
Share that with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Sure, I do have a comment.
Okay.
It's not you. You're the wrong counsel in making the comment. I'm going to look to my left, which is rather rare on my case, to counsel and say, I would be curious to know or get a background at some future point on veterans benefit registration. In my day, when I went to school, the veterans officer inside each higher institution had to approve and knew exactly which benefits each veteran was getting benefits. So if you're in an institution, any place across the board receiving financial aid and getting the benefit, the institution already has a list of the individuals getting the benefit, and the integration of that into their computer system seems to me to be an IT issue and not a policy issue. And I may be missing the boat completely, but I'm sure someone in HEC can get that answer for us. If you would, please.
Now, we might be just old people here. Right? They don't do it that way anymore. But in the old days, it used to be that way. So.
My recollection, Mr. Chairman.
Are we going to read Wyckoff's? I just wanted to point out some things. John Wyckoff's testimony. Okay. In his testimony, he's stating that campuses should create a priority enrollment system that will definitely include veterans. I think that is covered here. But what he says is that students are assigned earlier registration windows based on the credits they have earned. And following the requirements of House Bill 2645, a veteran entering a community college would be assigned a registration period earlier than new students. However, they would not be ahead of students who were 4 credits shy of graduation. And he lists a number of different scenarios. And how specific does this bill get?
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
the bill was intentionally non-prescriptive. And the purpose behind that was to not make it any more institutionally difficult than was necessary. And it recognized that among higher ed, there may be different challenges at different schools, and that they might need the opportunity to be able to adjust things according to their own needs. It's not that we would necessarily bump someone who needed four more credits, but rather the focus is get the veterans in, give them an educational opportunity, make accommodations for the life challenges that they face, and hopefully the institution would be able then to accommodate everyone's needs accordingly. And so, again, it was non-prescriptive.
Okay. Well, he goes on to say that once the veterans have completed one term, once they've been there, they are now in an earlier registration group than new students with no credits, and then they will be bumping those students that have one term also. So, in a sense, I think it's working. It's far more complicated than... And, I certainly envisioned.
And Mr. Chairman, I think now everyone here is beginning to get a feel for the types of institutional challenges that each of the schools are facing. And I have to say, I'm repeating myself, but I've seen some very good and very hard and difficult work that's been accomplished, and a number of hurdles jumped over already, but... If we're expecting, and that was fully my expectations, that we continue to move forward on this, it's going to take some work, and we're going to have to sit down together and chart a path.
One final comment, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
And Representative Witt, you followed this, and obviously I'm not asking for any names or anything, but I'm getting the sense that there are some institutions who have done better than other institutions. Am I missing the point here? I think that some have not done it as good as they should have done it, and that's really the point. Is he nodding going across the table?
Chair and chair. I think that given the number of institutions involved, one would expect that to be the case, absolutely so. By the same token, I'm not seeing a resistance that would say, well, we can't do this, we're not going to do this, we don't want to do this. It's more of, here are the following challenges, and I think really there's an attempt at outreach, help us get to where your vision really is.
Anything else? Okay, thank you. I assume, Representative Witt, you will be continuing this conversation.
Mr. Chairman, think I have that obligation.
Since you started it.
That's correct, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much, and thanks again for those that came up and spoke with us today. So our next topic, medical marijuana in the federal VA health system, Anthony Taylor. Anthony is here.
Boquist and Lively, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to provide the committee an update on the Veterans Administration's policies regarding the use of therapeutic cannabis by veterans within the federally administered VA healthcare system. For the record, my name is Anthony Taylor. I am president of Compassionate Oregon, an advocacy group for medical marijuana patients. I am a U.S. Air Force veteran and served in the Vietnam era. Although I never left country, that's part of my category. I'm also a constituent of Senator Boquist, with whose help in the 2013 session, we successfully added post-traumatic stress disorder to the list of qualifying conditions for using cannabis, and we appeared first before Senator Mons Anderson's committee in 2013 and were well received, ended up with a due pass recommendation out of all committees, both sides of the House, and I really appreciate everybody's help on that. In the recently concluded session, Compassionate Oregon also proposed language that was adopted reducing the cost of a medical marijuana card for all veterans from $200 to $20. I've included in my submitted materials copies of correspondence between Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access Executive Director Michael Kravis, which precipitated VA Directive 2011-004. This directive, although having expired January 31st of this year, remains in effect until a new directive is issued, and we have no firm date or indication that a new directive is imminent. Also included is a Geppert report on the legal and clinical evolution of Veterans Health Administration policy on medical marijuana by Dr. Cynthia Geppert. PTSD is not the only condition faced by veterans where cannabis can be an effective treatment option. Many veterans also use cannabis to help mitigate chronic pain. The use of cannabis for both these conditions is considered a non-VA medication, but does not in and of itself administratively prohibit veterans who participate in state medical programs from also participating in VHA substance abuse programs, pain control programs, or other clinical programs where the use of marijuana may be considered inconsistent with treatment goals. And that is part of what I've put up here from that directive, where VHA policy does not prohibit and must not be denied VH services. But at the bottom, you can see it is the VH policy to prohibit VH providers from completing forms seeking recommendations or opinions regarding veterans' participation in a state medical program. I have been receiving veterans' health care over the last 3 years, and it has not been an issue with my provider, although some veterans in other states aren't as lucky, I feel very fortunate that here in Oregon that it doesn't create an issue. At the federal level, the local news coverage of recent legislation allowing veterans using cannabis within the VA healthcare system is slowly beginning to gain acceptance. Congressman Blumenauer's H.R. 667 Veterans Equal Access Amendment, amending the FY 2016 Military Construction and Veterans Affairs Appropriation Bill, was adopted, with a similar amendment adopted by the Senate. This House bill received bipartisan support with a vote of 23 to 189, including the entire Oregon congressional delegation. So, just kind of as a follow-up to the directive, this is out of the Geppert report showing the prohibited practices and the permissible practices. I know that since none of the veterans physicians can sign authorizations, there's not any problem with the veterans sending the personal medical records to a clinic that will issue an authorization, and they're very quick at it. I submitted a request to have my records forward, and it was there that afternoon. So I really appreciate that. So this is for your use and for your reference. And this is the language for the Veterans Equal Access Act. And I believe that is it. So now I've messed up display, but anyway, I know this is a federal issue right now, but it really affects and positively impacts veterans' use of cannabis within the state of Oregon. I know it's problematic for some people to get their heads wrapped around, but these policy changes allow the VA providers to have an open and honest conversation with their patients, and it also allows these providers to chart the use of cannabis by their patients, which opens up a huge amount of data that we can use to help justify or you know, prove the theory that this medication is actually helping these veterans. It's all anecdotal information right now. The Gephardt report suggests that, you know, the tie-up on the federal level for the Drug Enforcement Administrative to be the last call on authorizing research into this issue is problematic and should be assessed. I will say that Dr. Sue Sisley, out of formerly from Arizona, now in Colorado, has been approved by the DEA to conduct experiment or research on the use of cannabis by veterans at the federal level. So now she's going to move forward with that study, and we think we're going to be very pleased with the results. So in the final analysis, allowing veteran health care providers to allow the use of cannabis and begin to understand the positive impact of cannabis as part of a legitimate treatment plan for PTSD and chronic pain, the VA, a federally administered and funded agency, will provide the same, can provide the same path forward for states that want to integrate the use of cannabis into the treatment for civilians. I'm happy to answer any questions that I can, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide you folks with this information.
Any questions?
Just one question. Thank you, Chair. So you're saying that the VA hospital providers, is your provider at the VA hospital? I sort of wanted to get a feeling for, do VA providers that are actually working in the VA, do they prescribe medical marijuana?
Chair Lively, Senator Mons Anderson, they are not allowed to prescribe.
Yes, that's what I wanted to make sure
and,
was on the record.
But the, my experience has been there is the opportunity to have an open discussion with the provider, and is part of my record now, so that, you know, it follows me through, and this result, the result in charting and those procedures are really going to help the agency determine whether or not this really is a useful treatment and will be able to be integrated into their health care treatment plans.
Thank you.
Congressman Blumenhauer's bill, though, does not change that fact, the fact of whether the VA doctors could prescribe or not, or does it?
That's correct. What it does is open up the ability for that conversation to take place and for those physicians that are interested to be able to sign off on the authorization within a state program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And whether just a comment, thank you, Mr. Taylor, for coming. If just as an aside, there is some study now out that is looking very good to provide positive results for use with depression and anxiety, because some of the meds that people take for that actually can cause them to commit suicide. So I think it's important that we follow through on that. And, you know, I support being as broad as possible for treatment for people who have these conditions if they need them and they find it effective, you know. So.
Chair Lively, Representative Boone, I really appreciate your position here, and I just really think it's important. I know when we did the PTSD, we had bipartisan support, and I just really think it's important for them to have access to this.
Yeah, just a follow-up, too. I have several constituents who are following this really closely and have told their story, their anecdotal stories to me about being prescribed so many different meds, this to handle that, that to handle that, and this to handle that, and overall just being anxious because of it, and feeling depressed because of it. And so, it, you know, it's a way to, and this doesn't even start to talk about the cancer treatment. So
yes, ma'am, and I was watching a show last night on the Weedicate program, and it was devoted to veterans with PTSD and their use of cannabis. And the one veteran had hermitized himself, isolated himself to such an extent that he could barely get out of the house. And he was reporting that he was taking 16 to 20 medications three times a day.
Wow.
And the overall cost savings for cannabis, if it does prove to be as effective as the anecdotal stories will lead us to believe, will be huge cost savings in prescription medications, end-of-life care, and, you know, dealing with people raising the quality of life while they're here. So I'm encouraged.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So we're going to change the order at this point to allow Polk County. Polk County is a little removed from Salem. So allow the presentation on Polk County, the funding for the full-time veterans services officer. So we have Jennifer Wheeler, Cameron, and is Andy. Where's Andy? Commissioner Wheeler, thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair, I'm going to interrupt you because since I represent Polk County, Polk County is not removed. No. It might be distant, but it's not removed.
No, you're right.
I just want to point that out.
It's not even that distance when I think about it.
Holy cow.
It depends on what you call distance.
That's a can of worms you opened.
I know, I did. It's like I never said.
Right, it's an electric cycle, too, Mr. Chair. Why don't you?
Chair Boquist, Chair Lively, members of the committees, thank you for having me. I'm Jennifer Wheeler, Polk County Commissioner, and I'm here to talk to you about our new Veterans Field Service Officer. So just to give you a little bit of background, last fall, a group of veterans led by Wayne Crowder, who's a Vietnam veteran and also was the director of SOVA, Serving Our Veterans at Home, and he is a Polk County resident. He also has a group called Battle Buddies and a number of other ways that he serves with veterans in Polk County. He and a group of veterans came to the Polk County Board of Commissioners to tell us that they wanted to have a field service officer. With them was Yamhill County's service officer, Jerry, I can't remember his last name. And they talked to us about why it's better for the veterans to have a community-based, their own community-based field service officer. So from their presentation, I took that on, and our administrative officer, Greg Hansen, and I went over and had conversations with Cameron Smith at the ODVA, and Cameron and Mitch Sparks, and just to see if we could make it happen budgetarily. We took that back. We decided we could at least make a pitch to the budget committee, and we took that back to the other two commissioners, Commissioner Ainsworth and Commissioner Pope, and they both agreed. So this is pretty early on in the process because that budget was just approved this morning at 10 o'clock. So we're just getting started. It won't be adopted until the 29th of June, so we're very early in the process, but I find it very exciting. I am not a veteran. My husband's a Vietnam-era veteran, and his father was 17 when he was at Pearl Harbor. So I do have a little bit of a family interest there, but and also some very close friends. I also serve on the subcommittee for the Mid-Valley Homeless Initiative Task Force, the Veterans Subcommittee. So I'm serving on that with a number of veterans. Wayne Crowder has agreed to be on that committee, as has Steve Bob, who is the representative from the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. And Mr. Bob has actually agreed to chair that committee because it seemed more appropriate to me to have a veteran chairing that committee. I have had some pretty amazing contacts with veterans lately because of this. I have utilized Representative Evans' assistant, Evan Source, who's been a tremendous help to me to get in contact with people that I need to talk to about this field service officer. My hope is that the officer will be community-based, so there'll be different areas or different in each area of the county. There will be a place for that person. So I have, of course, talked with Steve Bob from the tribe. We need to make that official once. Had to kind of wait for the budget to be adopted. So I will be meeting with the tribal council very soon to see if we can have a spot there for the service officers so that the veterans who live in the Willamina Grand Ronde area would have access. Mr. Source provided me with the name of the coordinator for Western Oregon University. I put a call into him after the budget was adopted this morning. He wasn't available, so I will be meeting with him as soon as I'm able to make contact with him to see if we can't have a spot in Western Oregon University for those veterans who live in the Monmouth Independence area. We have a family whose son was killed in Afghanistan who own a building in Dallas. It's a small building at 1,200 square feet, but it seems like a pretty good size for a field service officer to me, and also a place where it's just veterans, not them having to come to a government building. Some veterans would prefer not to do that. The building's also large enough that they would be able to have other veterans organizations utilize the building. The family wants to lease the building to the county for a small price. We haven't negotiated that yet. In fact, the other two commissioners don't even know that that's happening because we're not allowed to talk outside of a public meeting, and so, and it's just pretty new. This has just happened. So that's pretty much where we are. It's very early on. I really thank Representative Evans for his help, and I have taken advantage of him quite a bit. Senator Boquist, I haven't chatted with yet, but you may have received emails, even though I haven't had a chance to get in touch with you, but I do plan on doing that as soon as possible. So, unless you have questions, that's...
Commissioner Wheeler, you're to be commended for your efforts to do this, to bringing this together.
That's well, Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, I haven't done that much. Sure. I've had some pretty good help, but it's... actually, the praise goes to Wayne Crowder. I don't know if any of you have met Wayne, but Wayne pretty much, when he sets his mind on something, he goes for it, and he's kind of hard to say no to.
Thank you. Sure. Yes. Sure, thank you. I just want to say two things. One, this would not be happening, would not even be close to be happening if Commissioner Wheeler was not at the helm. And number two, having watched veterans policy in Polk County for a number of years, in this business, it is very easy to say, well, you know, congratulations, good job, nice work. The fact of the matter is, Commissioner Wheeler has been spearheading a fundamental change and transformation in the way the county views that position. And it is admittedly a partnership and a network, but she not only needs to be commended, it's a model for how other counties that maybe haven't had some of the same level of investment can actually do so. It is truly a remarkable process. And her efforts in terms of making sure that homeless and the programs necessary to get folks from homelessness to self-sufficiency and the veterans alignment really can't be overstated.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mary. And I just was going to suggest, but he's not here right now, but Senator Courtney has connections with Western Oregon. And I also regret to tell you that the cat's out of the bag and the boys in Kiev just heard what you said. So it's everywhere now.
Chair Lively and Chair Boquist, I appreciate that. I used to actually work with Senator Courtney. I don't know that he would remember that because it's a number of years ago, but when he was the vice chair or vice president of Western Oregon State College.
We're talking about you.
There he is.
He gave me a piece of personal advice that I took and have always appreciated from that day on. It was many years ago, 25, 30 years ago probably. So.
Annie and the director are going to...
Yeah.
And Director, we're not Cameron.
Good afternoon.
Let the Marine go for sure first, right?
Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And first and foremost, thank you to Commissioner Wheeler for helping lead this charge, along with that local veterans community out of Polk County in the Mid-Willamette Valley. Was an excellent collaboration to go through and models that partnership that we have had with county veteran service officers as a department literally for the entire history of our department. For 70 plus years, going back to that first year after World War II, 1945, ODVA stood up as a state agency and department, and Josephine County was the first county to move forward with a county VSO. And Polk County historically had one, but this has been 35 odd years in the making to bring it back. And it is not that, so about half of our general fund budget flows down through ODVA to the county veteran service officers. They focus on that boots on the ground outreach and developing those claims, both for disability claims, low-income pensions, access to health care. And we've positioned ourselves on that training, on that certification of those veteran service officers taking on that power of attorney, doing the claims review as their claims are coming up to the federal VA regional office, and on the appeals work when those claims are not rated successfully for our veterans. So we're building a very symbiotic system, and it's not that so for Marion Polk County, they have been serviced for their claim support out of our Salem headquarters here. Not that they weren't getting good claim support, but we were not, as a state agency, we are based in Salem here in Marion County, but we are not of that local Mid-Willamette community in terms of being in front of the county commission and working with the other county agencies, working with the local both veterans community and partners, both on that outreach to the 7,000, 8,000 plus veterans that are in Polk County, and then not just to link them to the federal VA, but to link them to other community resources. And often we are trying to elevate our outreach as an agency to value add across those other county VSOs and across associations. So when there is an interest on working on homelessness for veterans in Polk County, we can do it and we can provide it. But it's not something we can offer to every county, and to try to elevate our work so that we are supporting those efforts statewide is our continued mission. But a big thank you to Polk County moving forward. We'll incorporate, so they will come online January 1. We'll work with them in the hiring process to get the best candidates selected for their county VSO. We will incorporate them into the state pass-through, and given the last half of our biennium, or the last quarter of our biennium, a very small impact to the other counties, and we will incorporate them into the pass-through going forward. So happy to take any questions at the end.
Thank you, Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, and members of the committees. My name is Andy Smith with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I think Cameron should get a boy as well, because this clearly wasn't. Commissioner Wheeler was absolutely essential, and Mr. Crowder was essential. But Cameron, I think, believes in this model, that this is a local community-based model. And I'll just say I've been to his office a number of times and kind of seen how a individual vet would encounter a CVSO. You guys do the best you can, but it's not the same experience knowing that I might come to Dallas and I might go into a building that's a community-based. It's a place where veterans could hang out and feel with each other. I mean, it's a very different model. And I think it's so Cameron has had that vision. His agency has that vision in terms of how this work is done best. And again, it's really the two pieces of the model. It's, you know, two sides of the same coin. It's the access to these huge federal resources, which I want to give you some latest data in just a moment. But then it's that community work that is, you can't do except in the community itself. These things can't happen. And I think you're 2 months in, or how long? When was this decision made? Was it 2 months even?
Well, the actual real decision was made at 10 o'clock this morning.
10 o'clock this morning. She's already got a deal.
They're close. More locked in previously.
That's Polk County government right there.
It's by the papers here. This is news. So,
the pants government is
I guess the point for me is that this community stuff that's starting to just come up, it was always there. It just needed a local connection. It needed a connection at the county level. It needed a public presence. It's not just nonprofits or partners. It needed this public convener, which is a commissioner. So right now we'd have one county that's left that's not in kind of under this model, but I think they'll come to the same conclusion. I mean, I think they're kicking that around. But how would it be different and better to have a model that's really closer to the community and again can do these two purposes, access these federal dollars but then also do this community work. So what I wanted to share, I'll bring over to your administrator, is some recent data from the federal world that tells us the story. And I'd just like to go over that quickly if that's all right, Mr. Chair. Is that all right? We do some of that?
That's Kim, he's in charge.
So it's a little bit aside from this discussion, but it informs, you know, the work that we're doing. Cameron. So you'll see this in just a moment, but it's a great little piece that kind of tells the story. So this is the data that we get is from the federal world, and the actual office, I guess it's called the National Center for Veterans Analysis and Statistics. So it's a VA entity, But when you see this, and you might have it in your computers or you'll have it at some point, would be it shows what's happened from 2000 to 2009 in these trends and resources. So we've talked about it before. From 2007 to 2014, these things have doubled. The amount of healthcare dollars that come to Oregon have doubled from $500 million to a billion.
In what period of time?
2007 to 2000—the period here is slightly different, but I'm kind of telling the same story, that if you take a seven-year period, it has doubled the last from 2007 to 14. The window here that you're going to see is slightly different, but the trend line is the same, and that is we have veterans taking advantage of federal benefits like they really haven't before. And again, the two cornerstones of federal benefits in terms of the size, it's health care. Is the second, and number one is compensation and pension. And they're both in Oregon. The compensation and pensions about $1.3 billion, and the health care is $1 billion a year. So if you went back 7 years, it would be half that. That's the trend line. So when you look at these numbers, you know, you can take it back to your office and kind of say, you know, should we be in the, should we keep doing this work? Should we leverage this work? And what we try to tell you from the county perspective, our commissioners, you know, the answer is yes, and really strong HS, because there are other federal systems where the money is there, but this is clearly one of them that it's not a question of whether they're there. There's a question of, are we there? Do we have the capacity to put these claims in the system and do quality work? We need boots on the ground to do the work in Oregon. So the other reference that you're going to see, and you can look over this, and I won't go over this in any detail other than to say they're great summaries. You can see the difference. Like, this is on page 5 of that handout. You can see the health care. You can see the number of vets served. See, health care is clearly the biggest. The compensation is right behind it. But then the other benefits are, they're not insignificant, but they're much smaller. And I guess the other thing that I point out, there's a page in here, which is page 9. And it looks at the probability of male veterans to use a VA benefit. And what this shows, so this is on page 9. When I looked at this, if our older veterans are World War II, Korean, and Vietnam, they use this at a higher rate. Our more recent vets, they're not using them as much. So if you go to that page, what you're going to see, we have work, to me, this says we have work to do. We can move these numbers up. And that's the whole point. When, you know, when have we hit kind of capacity? I don't think we've hit it yet. And I think the more that we invest in the basic community resources, the CBSOs, and the community model, the more that vets will engage in these services, get access to their benefits, and we'll see these numbers continue to grow. They're not going to grow forever because the demographics will shift at some point. But I think there's a lot of growth in the system. You'll see that our most recent vets are not accessing benefits as much as the older ones. So that's, to me, that's the story, that we're on the right path. But again, not to be, this won't last forever, but it'll last for 10, 15, or 20 years until the demographics change in terms of the growth.
Thank you.
Thank you. And maybe this is for Cameron or Andy. How many Oregon veterans do we have now? Or do we know?
331,000.
331. Thank you.
But I would also note the numbers that we've looked at when we've come before you the last year, they've been 2014 numbers. We're waiting. I don't go quite every day, but I'm going every 2 or 3 days for the 15 numbers because we want to see what that trend line is. And we've had some early data, but we don't have the hard numbers, so we'll see what that number is. It probably should go down, I would guess, but, you know, because we have more folks dying than are coming in.
Yes, Chair. Ms. Yeager and Cameron came to speak to our Human Services Committee about housing, and I found it really interesting that out of those over 300,000 veterans, over half of the Oregon veterans are 65 years of age or older. So that, to me, was extremely interesting. And then most veterans, of course, are men. And with the male veterans averaging, their average age is 64 years of age, and women it's 48. So, but yeah, over half serving in World War II, Korea, or Vietnam.
Any other questions or comments?
I just want to thank Commissioner Wheeler and the good director, and also follow up just for the comment. Commissioner Wheeler is absolutely great. The Grand Round Tribe in the veterans issue has been a great nation state partner. They have reached out and pulled their weight, and they do all they can for veterans. And the only hope we can have in the future is to get the 36th county.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Okay. Very good.
Oh, really? Oh, I guess it is.
What?
It's Marion County.
So,
yes.
One last thing. Get on up here. So, we
thank
started
you,
the meeting
Senator.
By meeting the
news. Thank you for your meanness and criticism.
Some of the legislation things we're done. Now we're going to complete the meeting by meeting another new member of a position that we agreed to take in recommendation. So.
Good afternoon again. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And as we just discussed, we are building a shared state and county veteran services system for all of our 330,000 plus veterans across the state. And with tremendous leverage off of that federal VA, drawing down that $1.3 billion for that 2014 number in disability compensation and pension, the over $1 billion in health care benefits, plus the GI Bill and other wraparound benefits. And that is because of the advocacy of those state and county partners, and we are a top 10 state in terms of leveraging that federal VA opportunity. Not just, and when we were testifying on the Senate Housing and Human Services side, not just that leverage of federal VA dollars, but also what it then can save and preserve and extend in terms of general fund, whether on our more senior veterans that are in long-term care and skilled nursing, what could we get shifted from that state share of those costs over to the federal VA, creates powerful opportunity to save funds, to reinvest back into the local veteran system. But as we build that system for all veterans, we are also focused on doing outreach and support to underserved veterans populations. Again, our aging veterans, 52% of our veterans population served in Vietnam, Korea, and World War II. Senator Boquist is an aging veteran that we want to take care of. Our women veterans, the fastest rising demographic.
I don't even have a comeback for you.
Women veterans today, 9% of our veterans population, and projected to just grow to a quarter to a third of our veterans population going forward. Rural veterans, while smaller in number, make up a quarter to a third of their population in those rural counties for us. Our tribal veterans that we talked about, while less than 1% of our veterans are tribal members, have served at a higher level per capita than almost any other group. So it gives me great pleasure, and we've invested in this specific outreach. Another one would be incarcerated veterans in the task force out of legislation this last session, another underserved group. But it gives me great pleasure to introduce another leg of that stool for our diverse Oregon population to work on support and outreach to our LGBT veterans community. Nathaniel Bamey will help lead the charge as our newest team member at ODVA and brings a tremendous amount of experience, is actually still serving in uniform with the Air National Guard, deployed to OIF almost 10 years ago in 2006 in support of those combat operations. Brings a lot of outreach to the LGBT community, but a lot of expertise reaching out to homeless advocacy as well. Has a master's, and hopefully not taking all of his talking points here, has a master in sociology, and very fortunate to have him joining our team, and just wanted him to introduce himself and share what he envisions for the role.
Great. Welcome,
man. Chair Lively, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nathaniel Bamey, and I am the newly appointed LGBT Veterans Coordinator for the State of Oregon and the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Firstly, I want to thank the assembled members for the opportunity for this position even to exist. It's a privilege and an honor to be sitting here before you, and truthfully, for me as a veteran and part of the community as well, it speaks volumes as to Oregon's commitment to veterans, period, no matter their sexuality, gender, race, creed, religion, or any other typology that you'd like to throw in there. And it's wonderful for me. I started serving veterans a little over 6 years ago in different capacities, both in and out of the military, in Portland, in Seattle, and most recently in Los Angeles. And as Cameron had mentioned, most of my experience has been with veterans and their families in crisis, most specifically housing stability, through the SSVF, GPD, and related programs across the West Coast, actually. And it's my again, absolute excitement to be a part of this role and to be a part of this team, truthfully, seeing the work that's going on here in Oregon and nationwide. First of its kind in the nation, and it's humbling. Truthfully, it's very, very humbling, and it's exciting to see what's going to happen. I'm not sure if the assembled members know, Portland actually has the second highest per capita LGBT population outside of San Francisco. And so determining what the needs of this population is while performing traditional VSO work to include claims and discharge upgrades and truthfully whatever those members need for those veterans specifically and all veterans in general. If there are any questions, I'm more than happy.
I have one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you're still in the military. And what is OAF?
Chair Lively, Chilbert Boquist, excuse me. The OIF, Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Got it.
And yes, ma'am, I'm still serving in the Oregon Air National Guard, coming up on 15 years total military service in September. Third generation Air Force myself. So.
Well, thank you for your service.
I just have a technical question for you, right? Do you find it hard being an Army Air Force guy working for a Marine?
Here we go.
Sense of humor.
Chair Lively, Chair Boquist. Not at all.
Okay.
I love the inter-agency inter-component rivalries, but as we all know, we all help each other, and you know, you guys need a ride somewhere, so I'm sure you like having me, of course.
The Navy's going to jump in here. Before he jumps in, coach can do this, is the nice thing about this, us veterans can, you know, argue amongst each other, but when people want to pick us veterans on, we all gang up on them. So
yeah. I just want to emphasize that 10 years isn't that long ago to have been in Iraq. For those of us that were there in 03 and 05, you're a young man.
Remember, Sandy, until you lean forward in the light, I thought that was blonde hair.
You were there, the Persian Army was
okay,
there.
One more thing you've got to know about this group is you're in the front row now, but your place is in that back row with the usual suspects that show up in this committee.
Chairs, members of the committee, I think it is telling that we are a diverse community as veterans, and we stand together in uniform on the battlefield when we are serving in the military. And we stand together with one voice as a veterans community, but we are diverse. Those differences don't divide us, but they unite us. But perhaps that one area of difference is the branches of our five armed forces that may be still a challenge to get over going forward.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Look forward to working with you.
Congrats.
Anything else to come before the committees? Anything from...
I did go out in the hall. Well, you were leading very well here, by the way, okay? And talked to Representative Witt, and he was going to work with the institutions and follow up on the question that I had in regards of veterans. And then I committed our good committee staff with your blessing that if Representative Witt needs help jerking their chain, that committee staff will help him in this trying to get the implementation of this bill.
Thank you very much. I think that's very important.
Shouldn't have to jerk.
Chairs, just a real quick comment on House Joint Resolution 202 now, ballot measure, or at least technically ballot measure 404 until we get a real number for the fall.
IRR 404.
Thank you to everybody that was involved in helping clarify the language. I want to especially thank President Courtney and Speaker Kotek and Representative Buckley and everybody who was involved in making sure the DOJ language got changed. Okay. And for those that are interested, and perhaps if the chairs want to do this, as the process goes forward, there's going to be a number of opportunities to communicate about the potential ballot measure, as well as perhaps an opportunity moving forward for some consideration of a group that could get together, a work group, yes. As far as ideas to bring people together to talk about if it is passed, what we can actually spend it on and how. And I know that there's a lot of different ideas out there, and I think that the chairs of this committee forming that, I think, would be the best option moving forward if that is what you'd like to do. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Suggestion. Okay. We're okay?
Oh, we're okay.
Thank you for my colleagues for joining us today.
Representative from the Task Force and Workforce District.
You adjourn first or do I?
District.
You do.
He's going to keep
so the House committee will be adjourned.
The Senate committee is adjourned. Thank you.
Senate committee is adjourned. Thank you.
Committee will be adjourned.